And now, The Low Post.
Welcome to a Friday edition of The Low Post podcast, where we are three games total into the conference finals, and we will be four games total very soon and waiting for that game in Milwaukee. And kind enough to take a little time out with us to talk all things lottery, offseason, conference finals. My friend Kevin Arnovitz, how are you doing?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm good. I'm going to see you back on the East Finals again next week. I enjoyed a few hours in Milwaukee the other night. Milwaukee becoming one of my favorite NBA cities with the new arena. It's so convenient. Milwaukee, like, the convenience factor is it might be the number one most convenient city.
Yeah, user friendliness is a big criteria. You know, like Salt Lake, because everyone always laughs when I enjoy saying I like to go to Salt Lake. It's just user friendliness as a metric for, like, where do you want to be for 4 or 5 days. And they've made it very user friendly here in Milwaukee.
Oh, it's, I mean, even the airport is like 8 minutes from downtown. There's nobody ever at the airport. The last time I was in Milwaukee, flying out of Milwaukee, there were literally zero people in the security line, and the guard was like waving, "Hey, come on down, sir. We're happy to have you. Come on."
No, I was like, "It's great. It's like flying in and out of the 7-Eleven. It's fantastic. It's wonderful."
Well, you're going to be flying out of there soon, and you'll either fly out with the 2-0 series that looks like a Bucks stranglehold, or the Raptors will come up with something interesting tonight to reverse what felt like a pretty tough game one loss. But we shall see. But the big event of the week was, of course, the New Orleans Pelicans winning the lottery after months of speculation of what the lottery would mean for the Anthony Davis sweepstakes, whether the Lakers would move up or the Knicks would move up or both or neither, or what are the Celtics going to do, blah, blah. Anthony Davis's team won the lottery. I think that's obviously a very interesting plot twist. What were your initial reactions? So now there's been an outpouring of coverage of, you know, Griff is playing the why would he want to leave. There are rumblings of, I believe Jackie McMullen said, over Gail Benson's dead body, which is a little bit morose. Would they trade Anthony Davis to the Lakers after all the hard feelings of the last 6 months? What were some of your initial reactions to this crazy turn of events?
Well, I mean, I was at least glad it was the Pelicans and the Grizzlies and not the Knicks and the Lakers, particularly the Lakers. I was pleased for that. It's going to be really interesting, like, who are the true suitors? Like, we think there'll be these monster packages, but constructing packages for max talent is just really hard. You have all these moving variables. And I'm also very, you know, I keep hearing mixed news and conflicting accounts of whether or not Mrs. Benson would allow Davis to be traded to the Lakers, who actually now have a more attractive package by virtue of the fact that they got four. And that's a really interesting question. Will the Lakers be allowed to be full participants in the bidding process? And the question is, do you want to trade them? And the power of persuasion of David Griffin to say you want to be here. I mean, my sense is if he's willing to stay, you want him to stay, right? For the sole reason that you don't get value on a max guy. And, you know, Anthony Davis, if he is at maximum output, is going to outproduce the $27 million and then 28. Well, he probably would opt out at 28.7, but he will exceed in value his contributions, what he's getting paid, which is what you're trying to do as a basketball team, right? Like, at the end of the day, it's the all you're trading, not playing players, you're trading contracts. And you measure a player's value within the context of the salary cap as to, does this person, do you get your money's worth? And you're going to get your money's worth with Anthony Davis, provided he's healthy.
Yeah,
Anthony
Davis is 26. I saw David Thorpe, friend of the program, made this argument in True Hoop today that they're better off trading him and just doing a Herschel Walker trade and making Zion the centerpiece of a super talented 23 and under team. And I get that. Because Anthony Davis is 26, he's 6-7 years older than Zion, due to their time to blah, blah, blah. I get all of that. I just don't know that such a trade package exists to them. I don't know that any team can give them I don't know where the blue chip picks are in that theoretical. I mean, you can go through them all. The Lakers, it's going to be the number 4 pick. Okay, maybe that's one. And some young players that are interesting. The Knicks, they have the 3rd pick, so that's one. They have the Dallas picks, which are interesting, 2021 and 2023. They have some downside risk to them from Dallas' perspective that makes them attractive. Boston quietly has they have 14, 20, and 22 in this draft. And after that, one future first left of all the trade assets, and it's the Grizzlies pick that's top six protected next year. And we'll talk about Kyrie. And then I think you have the Clippers as a looming wild card, and there's going to be a surprise suitor. I don't know that any of those, unless you get Boston to give you Tatum, Brown, and the Grizzlies pick, which is not going to happen, I don't think, in any circumstance. Even if Kyrie stays there and tells them today that he's staying there so they're free to give their best stuff, I don't know that you're getting all that. So I agree with you. I just think if he's willing to stay, you keep him, because I don't know that there's a trade package out there, even with the age difference, even with the possibility to turn one into five. I just don't know that there's five that equal that one anywhere.
Right. I mean, those deals just don't exist all that often in the NBA. And I think in some ways the Brooklyn-Boston deal probably spooked a lot of executives from even making those sorts of
laying
out those future offers.
First of all, that's the deal to bring up, right? Because Boston got the Herschel Walker return because Brooklyn's picks ended up being so high. I don't know that. I mean, it's so hard to engineer that kind of trade where you trade really good players to somebody's team and still get really good picks back. And I think that trade is such an outlier that it's a very hard kind of trade to find. And one result of this lottery, everyone is like, oh my God, no one's going to tank anymore because the lottery has become so unpredictable. These teams rise up from the middle. People are still going to tank. They're just going to tank in different ways. They're going to tank in the middle of the lottery as we saw this year. The league knows that. But I think to your other point, one of the trickle down effects of that lottery is, teams are going to be much more careful about trading lottery picks. They're going to be much more careful about, okay, we need to get at least top four protection, top 10 protection, top 12, whatever it is. Like, we need to make sure we protect ourselves from the possibility that some innocuous looking pick we trade ends up being the number two pick in the draft.
Yeah. I mean, that's what flattening does again, which is why it's whack-a-mole. I mean, and I don't want to litigate why I think the draft lottery is dumb again, which I've done on your show probably five times in the last 5 years. I don't think these blockbuster deals will exist anymore. And I think the teams left holding the bag with an unhappy pending free agent, now apparently 2.5 years out of the official end of his deal, are just going to be screwed. And which is why that if David Griffin has the power of persuasion to keep Davis, who again is 26, not 28, I think you just do it. And, I mean, the other thing is, I mean, let me ask you a totally crazy question.
Yes.
What if you just say, given everything we just said, given the fact that these deals don't exist, what if you just say to Anthony and Rich and you just say, you know what, man, we're not dealing you. You know, I mean, and if you want to forfeit a second consecutive prime year in your career, I mean, that's really on you. But we're not dealing you.
Well, that's
what we think. It's complete fantasy, and I realize this, although I'm just playing out the hypothetical.
Is it, though?
I mean, what does Davis do?
But is it? I mean, David Griffin told me, a very giddy David Griffin told me in the ballroom of the lottery, we can be Oklahoma City with Paul George. Now, there wasn't a pre-existing negativity and nastiness between the two sides, obviously, so they're not equivalent, but that's essentially what he's saying. He's like, hey, you know what? Maybe 20 games into playing with Zion and Drew Holiday, and, you know, both of those guys, Drew Holiday's still only like 27 or whatever he is. Isn't he? Drew Holiday's not old. Maybe AD's like, oh my God, this
isn't terrible. And I think it goes beyond that, Zach, right? I mean, it's, and I don't mean this as a slight on Dell Demps or anything else, but if you're David Griffin, you can also say, look, all the ways in which you've identified this organization is bereft in certain ways, you're not going to exist anymore. I want you to give me 6 months to a year, and you're going to watch the infrastructural improvements in this organization. You're going to watch that we're going to value the right things in a way that we haven't previously. And this is not going to be the rinky-dink bastard child of the Benson Saints empire any longer. And, I mean, look, I mean, this is some highfalutin stuff, but I just think that he has – the capacity to say to Davis and the camp that this is not your previous year Pelicans franchise anymore. And for, not forgetting the fact that we're getting this guy and the excitement that's going to brew in the building and the city and everything else. And forgetting the fact that, that you will not find a better prime running mate in the backcourt than Drew.
Who's 28, by the way. He's 28, not 27. I was wrong.
Yeah, you're just, this is going to not resemble the franchise you know. Like, this is, we're getting a massive upgrade, you know, culturally and infrastructurally and otherwise. And I think that's a compelling case potentially. I mean, I don't know. I mean, if a guy wants to go, he wants to go. I mean, culture can't make anybody stay.
Hey, look,
I used to think it could.
There's an argument to be made. Now, look, the Lakers can get a third guy and trade for Anthony Davis. So you're this side, like, you maybe aren't just going with LeBron. Maybe you're going with LeBron and player X, whether it's Kemba Walker or Jimmy Butler, or they even get higher than that, which who knows. But there's a chance that at least for the near future, you're going with LeBron, who's 35, whatever he is, who's played by the middle of next season, will have played the third most minutes in the history of basketball, including playoffs. As great as LeBron is, there's an argument to be made. If they don't get a third guy that's a real stud, it might be more interesting 3 years from now to be on Zion Williamson's team than the Lakers with LeBron. I mean, it's not crazy. It's not a crazy out-of-the-box argument for David Griffin to say, hey, look, flash forward 3 years, you're 30, 29, 30. Where do you want to be? You want to be with the young.
You want to buy low or you want to buy high?
Yeah, it's not a crazy argument. Now, so I was in Chicago for 3.5 days or whatever for the combine, and after the lottery, everybody I saw milling around the hotel where everyone's hanging out, I was sort of like, okay, so now we know the Lakers have four, and they have Ingram, Kuzma, Hart, Ball, etc. The Lakers have three, and they have Smith, Knox. The Knicks have three. They have Smith, Knox, Robinson. Who am I forgetting? Nilakina. The Celtics have 14, 20, and 22, I think.
And the Memphis pick.
The Memphis pick. And all the young players that we know and probably saw their trade value take a 10% hit this season. I said, and the Knicks have the Dallas picks. And I said, who has the best package? Now, in my lottery write-up, my knee-jerk react, not knee-jerk because this is what I do for a living. I think about this all the time. But my initial reaction was, I think the Lakers have the edge moving up to four. I think Lakers plus their young players plus future Lakers picks and that fourth pick beats the Knicks with three and their young players and even with the Dallas picks. And I said that because there's the possibility that Smith is bad, Nilakina is bad, and Knox is bad. Now, I said on this podcast before, I am less worried about Knox's rookie season than the analytics guys who paint him as the worst player in the NBA. He may very well have been the worst player in the NBA. That doesn't bother me so much. I also realize I said the same thing when the analytics guys said, ooh, Andrew Wiggins' rookie year numbers are very disturbing. And I dismissed them. I say he's a rookie. I don't really, it doesn't, and you know what? They were right to say, okay, red flag right off the bat. So there's a chance. I don't know what the outcome is for all these players, but there is a chance that all three of those guys are bad. Just bad. And Mitchell Robinson is what he is, which is going to be, I think Mitchell Robinson is interesting. No one quite knows what to make of him yet, but he's interesting. The Lakers guys, for all their faults, are now they're going to be paid lots of money sooner than the Knicks guys are. But I don't think Brandon Ingram is going to be bad. He's not bad now. Lonzo Ball's not bad now. Kyle Kuzma's not bad now. They may be overrated in some eyes, but they're not bad. And the most common response I got was people agree. And then I thought I might be underrating the Mavericks picks. That's what gave me pause. That's like, in the light of day, I think I maybe skirted over those Mavericks picks a little too soon. But the reaction, if let's say I pulled 20 people, most of them said probably Lakers edge out the Knicks. And most of them still said, if things turn right, Boston still beats them both. What do you think?
I mean, it depends on what Boston's willing to part with. And that hits or no hits to Brown and Tatum's value. I mean, that gives you a forward tandem going forward for years. and it's whether or not those guys are available. The Laker package is interesting, and I've always liked that concentration of talent, I think, more than a lot of people have. But my issue is what do you want to pay Brandon Ingram in 2020? I mean, that's something that's looming now. It's not just you get a bunch of young guys on their rookie deals. I mean, you get a bunch of young guys on the rookie deals that are quickly with the clock ticking. And say nothing of, you know, what do we know about Ingram's health? And right now we don't know a lot. But you're going to have to make a decision about whether to pay that guy pretty quickly. And if you're somebody who believes that he is the most sort of he has the highest ceiling of that group, and I think, although, you know, Ball is such an interesting player, right? I mean, he's just in terms of what he is and what he isn't and what he could be. And I've kind of always been a Ball guy, but I just think that Ingram, given what you might have to pay him, it becomes almost a complicating factor. It's obviously an asset you'd love to have. Hey, talking about players as assets, but in the context of a trade, you kind of have to do that a little bit. You have to kind of measure what you're going to with their present value is, what their future value is, and what their future.
Hey, cost. It's a salary capped league. You only get X to spend. If you're gonna, I'm sorry, but if player is gonna take 30% or 20% of X, how much value is he going to bring? You just have to do the math. I'm sorry. Yeah.
And so what is an Ingram? What is it's July 5th, 2020, Zach. What are we talking about as Ingram's next deal? And the Pelicans are on the hook for it now. So, you know, what is that? Is that something you want? Do you believe in him?
Now the flip side is the Knicks guys come later and may come
right.
cheaper. But if they come
yes.
cheaper, it's going to be because they're not good. And that's not
right.
good either.
And I'm right now looking at Robinson and Barrett. I mean, what we're talking about is R.J. Barrett.
Yeah,
right?
You're talking about that's, three. That's
and how do you approximate that player's value? That's who you're getting. And you're getting a really nice five who could be a real defensive stopper for you and just – you know, it seems like he puts forward kind of the work and the energy to be at the facility every day, and he's going to be a positive member of a young core. But we're talking about Barrett as being sort of the ceiling piece there.
And that gets into so it's funny how these drafts, like, it was a two-player draft. Now it's like a three-player draft. Soon it's going to be a six-player draft. They always become X. The number of players that are in the draft always changes. But part of it is, and this is not, I don't pretend to be a draft expert or anything like it. Part of this is how big of a gap you think there is between three and four. But in the light of day with more time to reflect, I think Lakers-Knicks is actually a little closer than I painted it in my column, because those Dallas picks, now you can sit here and tell me they have Porzingis and Doncic. Okay, fine. I agree with you. The most likely outcome is those Dallas picks are going to be below the lottery, wherever they end up. They're not going to be great picks. But there's a downside there with Porzingis' health and whatever else has been going on. And you can also tell me that it's like that unprotected Heat pick that's been sitting out there for years now that the Clippers own via Philly. You can tell me that, well, the Heat know that pick exists. They're not stupid. They don't want to have that pick end up being a top five pick, even though it's a sunk cost and they shouldn't really care about that pick now that it's gone. Pat Riley is there. He's just not going to stand for a mediocre, well, they are a mediocre team. He's not going to stand for a bad team. He's not going to go in the tank and rebuild with that pick looming. You can tell me the same thing about the Mavericks. Cuban knows those picks are out there. He's going to spend his way to at least not embarrassment of having that pick really come back to bite you in the ass. Maybe, I don't know, but I think I skirted over. I think those picks are more valuable than I gave them credit for initially. Now let's go to Boston, because that is the interesting one, and in the off season, and it really begins more than anyone else with Kyrie Irving. If Kyrie Irving isn't coming back, and I think the Celtics' confidence has been shaken over what happened against Milwaukee. And they put on a brave face all season through the ups and the downs, worried here, not worried there, but I think they're worried now. If he's leaving, I just don't really know what you're supposed to do. I just don't think you can trade your best stuff for Anthony Davis. And we keep hearing these reports, well, Danny will do it anyway. Danny doesn't care. Danny's brave. And Danny is all those things. And please keep getting well, Danny. I just don't think you can trade. Let's just make it up. Tatum and the Grizzlies pick, or Tatum 14, 20, and 22, if you say it's Tatum or the Grizzlies pick, which frankly you might not be able to say given the other teams involved. So You don't have Kyrie Irving. You don't have cap space. Maybe you don't have cap space, depending on Horford, to really replace Kyrie Irving. And you're going to trade your best trade chip and or chips for Anthony Davis. And he's going to come play with Gordon Hayward, maybe Al Horford, Jaylen Brown. Like, you might have to trade Marcus Smart to make the math work. Maybe Terry Rozier. Like, I just don't think you can do that. I don't think that's going to be enough to get him to stay or to get any sort of confidence level that he's going to stay. And that's too risky to me.
Right. So your calculation is, because the question I have is, let's say Kyrie leaves. Do they do Davis anyway, which is what you were considering? And the question I always have with this is, do you make, if he's worth trading, if Kyrie is present, is he not worth trading for? If Kyrie isn't present, that was a little jumbled, but my point is, so you only trade for Davis, you only consider trading for Davis if Kyrie is there, with an understanding that, okay, that is a team that plays far enough to keep Anthony Davis's attention going forward, and you have a better chance of retaining him. If you trade him and Kyrie's not there, now he is the linchpin of a number five seed or six seed in the East, particularly if you have to part with all those other assets. And now that's just, Anthony Davis is not going to stay in Boston, a place he didn't have initial interest, because if you can't win a first round series. So that's your calculation, right? Like that Davis is worth trading for if he's the final piece, if he pushes you over, if when he arrives, you're ready to contend. And if he's not, you don't want to deal for him, because now you're just going to part with those things and you're going to lose Davis at the end of it, and you're going to lose those assets. And now where the hell are you at Boston in 2021? No Davis, no Irving, no Tatum, if that's true, no Memphis pick, and now you're nothing, right? Like, now you're back to rebuilding. Well, you had a couple bad rolls at the craps table.
You sound like you're more pro taking that risk than I am, though.
I don't know. I believe in their organization. I'm probably slightly more amenable to it than you are, but I understand that I don't know that I want to cash out for one non-guaranteed year.
So there's another player that I was talking to people a lot about at the Combine that loosely connects to this, and that's Mike Conley. I think the Mike Conley market is going to be – I think Mike Conley should have already been traded. I kind of don't understand why Mike Conley wasn't traded at the deadline. However, I do think things are going to break right so that it's not going to hurt Memphis having not done that deal, because I think Utah will come back to the table if they haven't already. Indiana will come back to the table. Detroit will come back to the table. And I think you'll see some other teams sniff around Conley, including Boston. I think Boston will explore, okay, if Kyrie's leaving, where can we pivot? And people have brought up Bradley Beal. We'll talk about Bradley Beal later. I don't know that that's a thing. But the pivot question with Boston is really interesting, because pivot number one is, can they thread this needle where, okay, Kyrie's leaving, but we think AD needs some other reason to stay here. Can we trade our non-Tatum stuff for a really good player like Mike Conley or Bradley Beal or whoever it is, and then trade Tatum for Davis? Is that, and so he comes here and he plays with Conley, Hayward, whoever's left, and that's our team.
But we have to assume that Al's going to opt in, right?
I don't know what Al's going to do. I don't know what I'm assuming anymore. At the beginning of the season, I assumed opt out and re-sign for less annual money but more years with Boston.
Right.
Because I just
they don't know what they need to do or want to do.
Right. Now, that scenario of threading the needle like that, I think is just too risky. You've cashed in all of your assets at that point for a very good player who's not Kyrie Irving and is older than Kyrie Irving, and your team is suddenly aged, and you're still maybe not good enough to get AD to stay. So then do you pivot just completely away from Anthony Davis and say, well, we've got to cash in some of these assets because we have all these picks coming. Let's get another good player, whether it's Conley or more plausibly than I think a younger guy like Beal or somebody like that. And I'm almost of the mind that, like, if you are going to strike out, just strike out. Like you just said, I have faith in the organization. If you're going to strike out, maybe try and sign and trade Kyrie just to get something, even a trade exception or something back, if that's even possible. If he's walking to a team with cap room, no one has to help you do that. But I just think rather than sort of pivot in a way that just sort of adds like a very good player who maybe doesn't fit the timeline of the team, if you have faith in the organization, like you just said, I kind of think if you're going to strike out, keep all the stuff and try to build the team in a new way going forward. And you will you have regrets? Absolutely. You'll regret not going harder for Kawhi. You'll regret not going harder for Paul George, although there were salary cap complications related to trying to wait. Remember, Paul George was traded at the draft. They wanted to wait to sign Hayward first for various reasons. The cap went down. The cap projection was lower than people thought it was going to be. There's all sorts of stuff. But you will have missed out on some opportunities, but I think that's still better than kind of flailing around a little bit. And by the way, speaking of the missed opportunities, hey, look, everyone killed Danny for holding on to his assets for Butler, for George, and for Kawhi. Butler, I don't really regret if I'm the Celtics. George, I kind of regret a little bit, but there were complicating factors. Kawhi, you might really regret, but let's see what happens with Toronto. Is he going to stay there? Could you have won him over? And they did. Irving was the guy they cashed in their assets for. And when that happened, all the people who were slamming Danny were like, oh, wow, now he's really pulled a rabbit out of a hat. This is what he was waiting for, and he still has some left over for Anthony Davis. And it blew up. It may have blown up. And if it has, like, you have some regrets, but I don't know that you can go retroactively through everything and say, well, this is a mistake. It's a very complicated. It's very hard to make these decisions.
Yeah, I mean, the template here, and it's not perfect, but I do have faith in quicker rebuilds on the fly. And I think the Danny Ferry, 2013 Hawks was interesting, right? Because, you know, that looked like a teardown, and they were able to maintain competitiveness and really build something pretty good. Now, ultimately, they probably didn't down the road they didn't rebuild again fast enough. But that I think there's enough there that the strikeout could rebound in a fairly timely manner. And when you also ask, okay, well, what's the alternative? I mean, are you going to contend next year anyway? It's really convoluted. I mean, that is because, you know, I'd forgotten about Horford. Like, you don't know what that guy wants to do. You don't know the variables that will determine that decision on his part or your part. What do you even want him to do? Right? Because, you know, can you be a team? Like, let me ask you a question. Like, what does their cap space situation look like if, let's say, Al opts out entirely and you lose Kyrie? Like, what does that situation look like?
That's the only scenario where you have some flexibility to sign another player.
So, but I that prompts the question, Zach. If you're Boston, is that what you want?
Yeah.
Lose Kyrie?
I don't know if that's what I mean. That's a different avenue to get another player without trading any stuff, which is interesting.
You know, we didn't really answer the great existential question here, and I'll ask it to you.
Okay.
Do you want Kyrie? Do you want him to stay?
Well, I think if you pulled every coach and every front office person and every scout and every whatever in the whole Celtics organization, you would get a lot of different answers.
I have gotten so many different answers, which is why I ask.
I think you want him to stay for this reason and this reason only. He gets you Anthony Davis, and he gets Anthony Davis to sign eventually a long-term deal. That's the more important than anything Kyrie brings to the table is that.
Do we know that's for certain? Do we know that Anthony Davis is going to enjoy playing with Kyrie Irving any more than anybody else ever has?
Just like we didn't know when they finally cashed in their chips. Remember, the big chip was the Nets pick for Kyrie Irving. After years of everyone making fun of Danny Ainge for not getting any of these other guys. And remember, part of the reason people liked that he cashed in for Kyrie was it was a guy you had 2 years with, not just one. So there was more of a runway, more time to win him over, more time to show how he fit in, blah, 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 blah. You know, everyone assumed that would go great. Everyone assumed, okay, Kyrie Irving's a Celtic now. And that turned out to be maybe, I mean, whatever happens, I think it's clear we can say on May 17th, everything's up in the air in a way that perhaps was not anticipated enough by people like us at the time. It's going to be a wild offseason. It's going to be, you're talking about Conley, and I think there's going to be a robust trade market for Conley. But even that is linked to something like, what do people think Kawhi is going to do? And because Kawhi leaves, I think Kyle Lowry becomes a really interesting trade option for a lot of the teams that are in the market for Conley. And you know, just like, can you imagine Utah with Kyle Lowry? Now, getting Kyle Lowry would cannibalize their ability to get a four like Tobias Harris or somebody like that in free agency, but he would be great there. You know, and he's a 1 year. I think even Phoenix, someone I was talking to, like, what can the Rockets do? Was a popular topic at the combine too, and like, okay, so Zach or whoever, where can you trade Chris Paul? Is anyone going to take Chris Paul? And the two answers that were common were one, or if the Lakers strike out and everyone, can LeBron trick the Lakers into trading for Chris Paul against their own long term viability? Two, Phoenix. And my universal response was, if Phoenix is so dumb as to trade anything of value for Chris Paul, Chris Paul's a great player. He's just in his mid-30s, declining in constant risk of leg injuries on a
and
team
about
that
across the $40 million a year barrier between 20 in the 2020.
Making an enormous amount of money for a team that is miles away from doing anything significant. And everyone's response was, Zach, you're talking about the Suns. Are you really sure they wouldn't do it? And I said, look, if they do that, if they trade anything of value for Chris Paul, let the GOAT become the GM of the Suns and start putting his hoof on the phone and making the trade calls. And man, like, that would be better than you just contract the team. Now, Lowry, you can sell me on because A, he's a good fit next to, he's a great fit next to Booker. B, it's 1 year. And, like, there's value to having a guy come in for a year and be like, okay, this is what competency looks like, okay? And he's younger than – that you can sell me on. So Lowry, if Kawhi leaves then, Lowry becomes interesting on that point guard market. And just – by the way, I've said all year, I don't know what the percentage chance is, 25, 30. I don't know if I'm willing to go higher than 30. I think Kawhi has a – there's more of a chance of Kawhi staying in Toronto – then it's been assumed, like it's been assumed all year he's going to the Clippers. I mean, it's like people talk about it like it's 100% and 90% and maybe it. I have to hear that and trust
it. I think it's
it.
Considerably less than 70.
Yeah, I mean, I think I've said all year, I think there's a real chance, and maybe I'm stupid. I think that shot mattered. I think it mattered a little bit. I don't know if it bumped the odds up to 35%, but there are reasons that I think that Toronto has a real chance. And if they actually pull it off, because he's clearly proven worth all the trouble and all the investment in these playoffs, it would be a one hell of a story. But if he doesn't, if they don't, and he leaves, Lowry becomes a really interesting player, and the Clippers, and if he stays in Toronto, the Clippers become the ultimate wild card in free agency. It's and then you start talking about, we got into the Rockets. I think the Heat are going to be incredibly aggressive trying to get their hands on one of these guys somehow, anyway, sign and trade this, that. I don't know what they have to do, but I know they're going to be aggressive. We mentioned Utah. It's just going to be it's going to be absolutely wild. Do you have any Rockets answers for me?
So the first question is, what do the Rockets need to do? I mean, are we just saying generically they need to get better? I mean, so we will assume that Harden and Capella are sort of linchpins there. I mean, Eric Gordon at $14 million.
Boy,
however, you know, he struggles here, he struggles there. I mean, that's a good
man.
Deal. That's a good deal. And PJ is PJ. I mean, PJ won them games. I mean, PJ is at $8 million in a final year of a deal. So, like, so what you're basically saying is, what do the Rockets do? What you're saying is, what can the Rockets get for Chris?
Yeah.
Who's still a very good player.
Or Clint. And I think of Clint the same way I think of Steven Adams when the Thunder got eliminated, and this was a discussion. Fine player.
Okay.
Fine player. Yeah. Horrible against the Warriors. Really bad series. Really good player. I just don't know that any center.
Well, this is what we've talked about. The center is a mercenary position.
Yeah. I just don't think they have
trading. I was talking about this with someone, with an executive the other day over a meal. And it's this. That I think teams are going to come to the conclusion, many teams already have, that center is not where you spend your money. You can go in, you can always find something in someone, especially in a league where there is a high probability that guy will not be on the floor for the five most crucial possessions of your season. And it is a mercenary position. I mean, and I think the farther the Bucks go, like the more proof is, you know, find me that at $3.4 million. Brooke Lopez, who is going to make considerably more money next season, without question. However, that it's a mercenary position. You just aren't going to spend 20% of your cap on a guy who is not who's a very good center. It's a mercenary position, and it should be you should employ mercenaries to do the work.
What do you do if you're Tim Connelly and you get the Wizards job?
Oh yeah, yeah. I would furnish very tastefully in Logan Circle. That's what I would do.
Okay.
That's a very nice place to live.
What's the piece of furniture that you care the most about when you're furnishing your abode?
Me?
Yeah.
Take
me inside, because you...
I have these sort of case study seating in my house, which I think you've seen. I also have this original Eames unit, storage unit that I love, and it's in my bedroom area that I'm really possessive of. I don't have a lot of things, but that sort of mid-century modern furniture is kind of that's my jam. That's you get me very happy in a showroom of mid-century modern furniture. Kind of Koenig sort of case study housey type stuff, and that's where I live.
The only piece of furniture that I ever really cared about was when we moved in. When we moved into our first adult apartment, we went couch shopping. And to my utter surprise, I was super into the couch shopping. I cared so much about the couch. What color is it? And we had some parameters. Like, it had to be a pullout because we have guests all the time. And so like a lot of the sleek modern couches obviously aren't pullouts, because pullouts are like they're like boats basically. But I sat on these couches. I was like, no, we got to go to another store. And my wife was like, I've never seen you care about literally anything like in our house. The couch.
Well, I mean, your Tuchus spends like a quarter of its life on that couch, right?
That's what I told her. I was like, I watch a lot of NBA games on this couch. It's got to handle a heavy volume.
It's a high usage couch. High usage, high efficiency.
Yeah, it can't
be
a mod.
Must be able to apparently fold into many positions. Yes.
Yeah, I don't. Well, what player? It's boring to compare it to like an all-star player. It can't just be the Monte Ellis couch where it's high usage, low efficiency. It's got to actually be able to bear high usage.
The Kawhi Leonard couch.
The Wizards. So,
what do you do in Washington? I don't know, man. I'm looking at it right now.
Do you really? What I'm asking is, do you trade Beal? Because you're in jail, you're in John Wall jail until that contract is up. And do you trade Beal becomes the most interesting question in the league for whoever takes that job.
I mean, and this goes back to the AD thing, right? I mean,
First of all,
the answer is, yeah, I'd trade anybody. What am I getting? And where's the great deal? Like, we know the teams that would be interested in Beal. And I'm just wondering, you know, what does the deal look like? I mean, first of all, unless you're dealing him into space, which you might, you're going to have to take back something of unsavory. I mean, he makes $25 million. And what are the future assets that you're being showered with? The Herschel Walker deals don't really exist anymore.
You get another future asset for taking on anything unsavory if you do, and you don't care because you're in John Wall prison for many years. And you don't actually one of the arguments against trading Beal is you don't have a lot of cap space because you're in John Wall prison, and cap space is one of the key tools of rebuilding, because you can take in, like the Nets have done and other teams have done, you can take in assets for dead money. The Wizards can't do that, so one way you do that is take on some dead money in a trade. I think it's a really interesting question. I think they will have a lot of leverage, even more so maybe after July 1st when some teams strike out in free agency or don't get the guys that they want. And Beal is at such a position of demand. He's very good. I put him third team All-NBA. Did you have him on All-NBA?
I think I put him third team, yes.
He's really good. He's only 25, turning 26 soon.
I don't give up. Again, he's too young. Again, I think this is a different question if Bradley Beal is 28 or 29.
See,
but I'm with you. You've got these two extra seasons. He's under, I mean, like, you know, I'm comfortable.
The sins of the past make me maybe lean a little bit toward trading him, because in trading Otto Porter for two guys who maybe aren't even going to be on your team next year, although I think they'll bring Portis back. Jabari, I don't know. And in trading Kelly Oubre for nothing of future relevance, because they just desperately needed the eighth seed, I guess, they've sort of – like, there aren't a lot of pieces for Bradley Beal to not grow around, but to grow around him. I mean, Troy Brown was all right, and Troy Brown's going to be an okay rotation player, and they have number 9, I think, in this draft. Like, that's all right. But it's not as if you're like, okay, I have Bradley Beal, he's 26. The argument for keeping him is that he's really freaking good, and he's just 26, and why not have a really good 26-year-old player on your team, even if you are in John Wall prison? Maybe he keeps us competitive when we steal a playoff berth, we host a couple of playoff home games. That's great. Maybe.
Or to your earlier point, Zach, the fact is you don't have to be bottom 3 or 4 anymore to get one of those good picks. Like, you know.
Good point.
So let's, right? Like, okay, you know, the best, it's a win-win, right? The best case scenario is he's exactly what you say. He is truly, you know, this is a top 10 to 15 talent, and he can get you a playoff berth in the East. Great. You have 2 home dates, 3 home dates. Maybe you surprise someone. That's fantastic. You keep interest in the market up. Worst case scenario is you win only 34 games, or you're not top bottom 5. But, hey, guess what? You don't need to be bottom 5 anymore, right? I mean, you know, the odds have been flattened a little bit. So it's a win-win, and I'm with you. He's a good basketball player on a good deal relative to his contributions. And I just don't – I just, again – and here's the thing. Do you trade Bradley Beal? The answer is maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but at some point, the longer you keep him, the more likely you are that a Herschel-esque deal might surface. I don't think you have to feel compelled to trade him. Like, hold on to him. Team, you're open for business. At some point, some team, all it takes is one, will come and make the Godfather deal. And frankly, I mean, I don't know about you, but – I anticipate with next year's Washington Wizards, Bradley Beal's production is going to be pretty damn good, isn't it?
Yep. I don't know how his mood will be, but his production will be pretty damn good. I started the thought process there. I said, why? Why bother? He's really good. He's young. I'm not going to trade him. I'll just keep him. I think there's a good argument to be made for trading him, too. And I would at least be very aggressive looking at what the offers are. And I think the danger in waiting, of course, is that, you know, the longer you wait, the closer his contract gets toward expiration, although it's not particularly close right now. He has 2
teams
more years.
Aren't paying for it. They're less inclined to pay with each passing day. They don't actually have him in their employ.
I
get that. But you got 2 years left. I mean, you got a deadline. I mean, I think that's the other thing, is you can do this in January and February.
It's going to be an absolutely wild offseason. I mean, just the season that we're having, this is like the basketball season is almost like the prelude to the real season. Let's talk about basketball. Novel concept. The games. There's a as I was leaving the hotel in Chicago to go to Milwaukee the other night, someone asked me, "Well, why are you going? Where are you going? Why are you leaving? This is the hot spot right now." I said, "Well, there's a basketball game happening. There's like 14." I was joking. I was like, "There's 4 teams left in the NBA. It's important games. Giannis is playing Kawhi. I kind of want to go see the basketball game." So, all of this stuff is like, these games are the whole point of it. To be one of these 4 teams is the whole point. You're going to go to game 2 tonight, so we'll save Eastern Conference Finals talk for next week. The Western Conference Finals is 2-0 Warriors after a stirring, and yet it's like the sitcom that has gone to the same plot device too many times. Comeback, like, okay, the Warriors fell behind by a lot. Rousing third quarter run, some clutch plays, great Draymond Green defense, and Andre Iguodala strip. They win. Yay, hurrah, hurrah. Everyone's bored by this. I mean, they do it with style and panache. You got to give them that. I think every time I watch the Warriors, well, okay, let's zoom out. What do you make of this? Tommy Beer tweeted this, and it's true. We fact-checked it. Not that he needs fact-checking. They're 29-1 in their last 30 games with Steph and without KD. And our stats and info group went further. Since they signed KD, they're 32-4 in that scenario. You know,
what do I make of it? It's just a continuation of what we knew in 2015-16.
But Andre's older. Harrison Barnes is gone. Andrew Bogut is mummified. Now Kevon Looney has come on, but Sean Livingston is on his last legs. Like, they're just demonstrably not as good as the 73-win team, to the point that there's this whole spirited debate on that I've been a part of, too. It's like, if KD leaves, where do you pencil them in this is the parlor game going around the whole league.
I think Pennsylvania is a top two West team, probably.
Number one? Are they just
maybe? I would say so. Like, I just don't look. First of all, Clay is even better and smarter than he was three years ago.
Very true.
Right? Like Steph. I mean, look, I know the insane numbers. I mean, Steph was otherworldly, and he's merely gone back to being one of the greats of all times in terms of quality. When Draymond is in shape, we forget how good he is, and he is in shape, and he is motivated, and he has something to prove, and he wants to get paid.
I want him to go one step further next season and just, like, start eating on the bench in January. It's like Draymond goes to the bench and, like, he's eating wings or something, and then in March it's like, oh, now I'm getting sick. He balloons to like 310, and then in March he goes on some Suzanne Somers diet and is playing like the defense he was playing last night. The guy is just you can have Steph's unbelievable and the shooting is unbelievable, and the fact that he turns these lineups, which is literally Steph Curry and four bad shooters, he turns them into dangerous lineups because two guys are on him all over the floor. It's incredible. The last 3 minutes of Draymond Green and Andre Iguodala defense in that game were like chef's kiss. Just, you just can't defend any better than those guys.
No, and that's why I just feel like I'm not a little surprised, but it's not as if we don't have evidence of this. And I know they're a little older, but I mean, look. First of all, part of the beauty of playoff basketball is you don't play back to backs, and the games are spread out enough. And you know, you can dispose of teams. You know, they got a few days off between the Houston series and this one. They'll have a few more. It is more forgiving in some ways of Iguodala and whoever else has gotten older. But I just think this is an exceptional, exceptional team. They were truly the most exceptional team in history, less than 3 years ago, with this core. And you know, next year when KD leaves, they're going to go, and they have a competent front office that is going to find the three man who doesn't need the Shane Battier 2012, the Damari Carroll 2015 type. You know, they'll find that guy, and they'll pay him the tax level, the taxpayer mid level at 5'7" or whatever it is. You know, and that person will miraculously, because 17 guys are chasing Steph Curry around a curl, and there's Klay Thompson over there, and Draymond can find anybody anywhere, you know, blindfolded. And that guy's going to somehow be like, you know what it's going to look like? It's going to look like Shane Battier 2012. It'll look like Damari Carroll 2015.
You know what?
That's what it'll look like.
Speaking of Draymond can find everybody, you said Klay's over there. If you want to, some people should rewatch some of the best Warriors possessions last night. Like any Steph pick and roll, which turns into a 4-on-3, it's really like a 4-on-2. Because C.J. McCollum on Klay is literally in his jersey with his back. He's not even watching the action. Like, he's clearly been told, like, if an earthquake happens, do not leave Klay Thompson. Dude, just nothing. If the basket stanchion falls on the floor, do not leave Klay Thompson. He's not even watching the ball. He's not watching anything. He's just watching Klay. And, like, there's face guarding, and then there's literally just not – there's obsessing to a degree that is unhealthy. That's what they're doing with Klay. It's really unbelievable the attention that he gets paid.
Because basically now you have two guys behind the play, a third guy who can't help.
Can't
because
move.
Because the imperative is not to. You know, and so, yeah, it just, you run out of defenders. I love watching this team without Durant on the floor. I mean, I'm not trying to pile
so,
on or anything.
No.
I've always been about the aesthetics anyway. I don't really care about – wins and losses. Like, I'm a dork, and I, you know, for me it's all theater and I in terms of just for the choreography, and I just miss that old Warriors basketball. It's where I kind of truly fell in love with the schematics of this era, and it's great to see again. I mean, those 4-on-3 possessions in the half court, like half court basketball is not supposed to be that much fun.
And
it's really fun.
And they're not better without Durant, because it's not possible to be. And so what you're seeing is, I think, so they're winning without Durant. They're great without Durant. They're just sort of less, they have less tools in the toolbox. Now, they don't need that tool really to beat any of these teams yet. They might need it against Milwaukee or Toronto. But there are some trickle down effects that I'm having Durant. Like, you can switch more against them, and we'll talk about the utility of that in a second. You can play Seth Curry, Damian Lillard, and CJ McCollum all together, right, and not worry about, oh my God.
That's the one thing, right? That's the thing that not having Durant affords the other team, is you can get away with lesser size. And that's really, to me, when you measure all of the Durant stuff, that to me is like the fact that he could put a lineup on the floor where Harkless was the big, essentially, nominally, would, you know, theoretically, crazily, and only get slightly maimed instead of being completely embarrassed, right? Like that to me is the Durant. Where, you know, I would be so reductive. Yeah, that's what Durant gives you, a little size. You know, like Durant. I mean, it's ridiculous. Right? Like, this guy is otherworldly talent. And again, my desire to watch him not be on the floor is just an aesthetic commentary. It's not because I think they're better or not better or whatever. But I do think that you're absolutely right about that.
But, and also, like, so part of the reason it's hard to gauge how good the Warriors would be next year if KD leaves and they get a year older and they have limited cap flexibility, all that. Part of the reason it's hard to gauge is because I think in the normal course of events, KD goes to the bench or KD misses his first game back. I think they have to get back in the groove. They can't get in the groove that quickly of like, oh, this is how we used to play. A, because when he's on the bench, they don't have all their best players on the floor. And then, you know, game one, they're kind of feeling it out. Like, they have to, and they've done it against Portland and they did it against Houston. They have to make that aesthetically pleasing style that you just talked about work. They have to cut with ferocity. They have to screen and slip screens at like full blast. They have to make the reads early, not on time even, not late for sure. And I think it takes them like a couple of games to rediscover like, oh, this is just how like vigorously we need to play to make sure all of these little feints and slips and screens and cuts that we're doing to make up for the fact that we don't have a guy that we can just dump the ball 15 feet from the rim. You can dump the ball to Steph. You just dump it to him 30 feet from the rim. He's a great isolation player. He's actually hurting the Blazers in isolation, just different kind of style. I think it takes them a few games to rediscover that, but they have rediscovered it, and they are just flying around. And Portland, for all the crap Terry Stotts took after game one, I think they were too low in game one, and you just can't get caught with your pants down like that against the Warriors, and they did. I think they've actually defended pretty well in this series. They're switching a lot, and for the most part handling the switches pretty well. When the Warriors slip out super early, like Draymond is a genius at that, to try to beat the switch, they're generally kind of doing that. They're tracking Klay really well. Like, Klay will come off a screen on one side, then a screen on the other side, and they'll switch, and they'll switch again. And, like, it's just, it's really hard. And you're going to screw up a lot because they put you through so much stuff. I actually think Portland's done a pretty nice job defensively. They're just really hard to guard.
Yeah, I thought they did a nice job on Thursday night, too. I mean, they were up to touch. Again, they split the difference a little bit, and it worked. But yeah, they're a more versatile defensive team than I've given them credit for. And given, again, how much size they gave up last night or Thursday night, I don't know when you're listening to this, listener, I was super impressed. That is not a collection of personnel you think of as having, you know, super defenders. It's just not a roster that you go, you know, there's anybody on that right now active that you just think other than Aminu.
There was this play where Klay ran around one screen on the left side of the floor. Rodney Hood, who's done a nice job in this series, was on him. Rodney got through the screen. Klay runs around baseline, gets a second screen all the way on the other side of the floor in the corner, like a really weird place to get a screen, like all the way out there from Livingston. Hood gets around that screen. CJ McCollum's on Livingston. He panics a little bit, and they jump Klay, both of them. Klay immediately, he's great at these little short distance, like dropping a water balloon kind of pass, just hits Livingston. Help comes, Livingston hits Jordan Bell dunk. And you just look at it, you're like, well, geez, what am I supposed to do? Like, they shouldn't have doubled Klay, I guess. They should have switched or they should have stayed home. But if you do that and you mess it up, he's hitting a three. And then they boom, 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 boom. They just make every decision so fast that you can go from playing a perfect defensive possession to playing a slightly imperfect one to their dunking. And it's like, okay, I just give up.
They're fun again.
And I don't know what you're supposed to do, and this is the genius of them, right? Like, so the Clippers in the first round, they just didn't guard Draymond and Looney at all, or Iguodala, any of these. They were just not guarding you. like to a degree that I think was even unusual. We're just not guarding you. Okay, well, they still gave up a million points because A, Durant went crazy, and B, the Warriors know what to do with that. Draymond gets the ball and becomes a screen setter, and no one's on him, and they get killed with threes. Okay, so we should switch more. Well, if you switch more, you all of a sudden can't help at the rim when they do break free because everyone is focused on switching off the ball and no one is focused on helping at the rim. It's just you're damned if you do, damned if you don't. With every, if you trap them, they kill you that way, and you just it's really hard. Like here's like there was a possession last night where this is how diligent you have to be. Livingston was posting up Lillard, and Harkless kind of dipped down to show some help. And that was enough to dissuade Livingston from taking Lillard to the basket. And then he kicked it to Draymond Green, who was Harkless's man. And Harkless immediately was like, uh-oh. Oh, okay, because I know what's going to happen now. Draymond's going to dribble handoff with Steph, and I'm dead. And he sprinted out as if, I don't know what. He sprinted out so hard because he knew what was about to happen, and that's what happened, and Portland snuffed it out. And that was,
is this the one where you just put the ball on the floor and got right to the hoop?
I can't remember. But they snuffed it out and made them do something else. And the point is, like, you want to help off these guys who can't shoot, and they punish you for that. And sometimes you help off them and you're not really even accomplishing anything. Like, finding the right balance of, I'm going to help off these guys, but not so much that they're going to kill me. And only when I'm actually doing something productive with my help, rather than helping on cutters who aren't even there. It's just a really hard balance to strike.
Yeah, no, I think it's funny. I was watching, it was kind of in the Sixers. I'm jumbled at this point. You know, I mean, I'm in playoff fog, but I had this thought the other day in kind of watching a half-court game with the Raptors and Sixers that unnecessary help is actually one of the things that kills you defensively in the NBA. Where's the help is actually probably less common than why did you help? And I do think that so many coaches preach scramble and activity, and certainly in the series, the Bucks and the Raptors. I mean, it is a gospel of Mike Budenholzer's defense that you will scramble and you've got the length and the athleticism to get back. And this has been one of the great debates ever: do you stay at home or do you help? But with the Warriors, you're right. Like there is no, they make that balance harder than any team I can imagine.
If you're going to help, you better.
And Draymond's exactly part of the problem, right? Because he's the portrait of the guy who on the surface is the guy you help off of all of the Clippers.
There was a three, right? That Steph made in the fourth quarter of game one where Draymond posted, and they run this play with KD usually, Draymond posted and Cantor was on Looney at the 3-point line. And Cantor went right down to patrol Draymond in the post as a help defender and was just standing there in no man's land, did nothing, was in position to steal the entry pass or try to, and didn't even like try to do that. Draymond gets the ball. Looney, with 20 feet of space between him and Cantor, sets a screen for Steph. Steph hits a three because Cantor's not on the other side of it. And so that's like, if you're going to help, help. If you're going to help, right, double team Draymond before you, if you're just in no man's land, just you're just dead. And like striking that right bounce is really, really hard. I just, you know, it's hard.
Yeah, they make it very hard.
And then that Draymond to Kevon Looney, like slip the screen, lob to Looney game, is just killing everyone. And it's very easy to say, well, Draymond is never going to shoot that floater. He just wants to make the pass. So let him shoot. Well, okay, so let him shoot. What does that mean? You can't just let him get a layup. So you have to rotate. There was one late last night where Evan Turner was the guy in the position between Draymond and Looney, which is like being in the NBA's version of hell. And he challenged Draymond, and Draymond lobbed it to Looney, and Looney dunked. And you want to say, well, let Draymond shoot. But what you really have to do is rotate so early that you kind of stunt toward Draymond and freak him out, and then get back and steal the pass. And like, rotate so early is like the top 2% of help defenders in the entire league can do that. And if you're not one of them, they dunk and you have to, it's just, it's very hard. It's by the way, so here's one for you. Ready?
Mm-hmm.
Andre Iguodala in the playoffs, 11 points per game, 4 assists, 4 rebounds, 54% shooting, 39 from 3, 66 from 2. His guarded heart. That's this season. That's his playoff numbers this season. That's what I wrote in my notes.
That'll do.
I'm going to double check that just to make sure I'm actually right.
How many minutes of the game is he playing? I'm just curious.
I believe 30, but I'm going to double check again because now I'm paranoid that I looked at like per 36 or something. Playoffs per game. Yeah, 11-4-4, 30 minutes a game. 39% shooting from three. The strip last night, just absolutely classic, Andre. His guarded Harden and Lillard. Let's say they win this year. He'll be a four-time champion and a finals MVP and a one-time All-Star. I'm going to call it right now. I think Andre Iguodala is going to make the Hall of Fame. I'm calling it. I think he's in. If they win this year, and maybe even if they don't, I think he's in. What do you think?
Basketball Hall of Fame, just they operate. You know, it's funny. I was more of a baseball fan growing up, so I feel like these Hall of Fame questions had very defined boundaries, and you know, we would blur them, and everyone had their own criteria. But you kind of knew in basketball, it's all over the place. And I do think being an essential member of historic core, especially having won an NBA Finals MVP, can do it. And, I mean, he just was really prolific for a very long time, even before he got there. I mean,
he's back to being prolific now.
But he was like, we forget he was a guy who was, 20 a game, 18 a game, 19 a game, 17, during prime. So he accumulated enough of those sort of raw numbers so that when it came time for him to be the, quote, contributor role player on an essential team, that's not merely – He did the man thing, right? He did the 40 minutes a night, team leading score thing for a pretty long time.
And was by the way, was hated in Philadelphia during that time.
Dre's a peculiar guy by his own admission. If I had a vote, sure.
I think he's. Sure,
I'm looking at the full compliment here. Yeah.
The
sure.
Finals MVP, I would have voted for Steph. I've said that before. I think the subtext of this entire conversation is, and I had a big argument with Max Kellerman earlier in the season, I think Steph remains underrated, even present day in terms of where he ranks. I think he's underrated. I think he's closer to the best player in the league than he is to like the fourth best player in the league, and I've said that many times. But I think Andre is going to get in. I think he was – so the finals MVP to me makes up – I think it's robbery that he never won Sixth Man of the Year. Absolute robbery. But if you look at all the one-time All-Stars that are in the Hall of Fame, most of them are in as coaches or international players, like one or fewer All-Stars, frankly. Then you have some of the Celtics guys from the 50s and 60s, like Satch Sanders and Casey Jones, who's in as a coach and a player. Calvin Murphy's a one-time All-Star. You know who's a one-time All-Star that's in the Hall of Fame? Bill Bradley. I thought he made more All-Star.
He only made the All-Star team one time?
I thought so, too. He made one, according to I'll double-check again. So there is some precedent for it, although it's incredibly rare for someone to get in with just one All-Star appearance. But I think Andre is getting in, particularly if they win this year. And in the playoffs, I mean, a big reason they've had their hiccups, right? Houston took them six. Clippers, that was like a weird series for a hot second. A big reason they are now two wins away from another finals is that Andre has turned back the clock and had, I mean, this is as well as he's played since like his first couple of seasons with the Warriors. It's been ridiculous.
Yeah, these are some nice playoff numbers. Yeah,
awesome.
These are really nice playoff numbers.
And his defense, I mean, he's guarding Lillard down the stretch of these games, if not at the beginning of them. And he's guarded Harden. He became the de facto option on Harden and is playing a huge amount of minutes. I'm not going to count Portland out. I don't think they're going to get both of these games at home. I do think it's time to change the starting lineup. They're getting smoked with Aminu and Harkless on the floor. And the floor is just one more shooter makes such a difference for them. The help rotations are a little longer. The passes are a little easier to see. I just don't think they can roll out that starting five for one more game in this series, whether it's Hood or Seth Curry or something. They need another shooter in the starting five. I would bet money, if I were a betting man, and I am not anymore, I would bet money that Terry Stotts makes a lineup change in game three.
Yeah, and I think Hood's the guy. Because I think defensively on the wing, I like it. Hood's not, he's not the structuralist, he's not he's relatively new to this team. I don't know that he's is a natural fit in some of those schemes, but there are enough attributes there in terms of size of the guard, defending the three position. Obviously, he can shoot, and it gives them another. It gives them an isolation score that Harkless and Aminu just aren't. I mean, this is really hard to play with a forward tandem. I've been a fan of the Harkless Aminu. I've always tandem in this team in this
they
core,
made shots
but I just
night.
Feel like he can manufacture stuff that they can't.
Well, and like I was in my notes as I'm watching last night's game, and they're just, you know, they're using Kanter as a screener, as they do, and the Warriors are leaving Aminu and Harkless completely wide open.
Yep.
There's no way to get to the rim. There's no way to do anything. Kanter's not going to make enough floaters and passes and whatever to make that work. And I'm like, well, maybe I wrote in my notes, maybe they should try Harkless or Aminu as a screener. And they did try that in the second half. And it's just, it's the same problem. Then there's Kanter and whoever's not in the screening action.
When these possessions you're talking about break down, like Aminu can't work off the dribble. It's just not what he does. Harkless can do it a little better, but it's not what he does. Like, to me, I mean, I'm not even talking first option in the compromises that those guys present because they don't need to be guarded as shooters. Like, I'm talking about the ball lands in their hands with 6 seconds left on the shot clock. And if it's in, I've always been I came very close to voting for him all defense a couple years ago. Like, I'm an appreciator of Al-Farouq Aminu and how he affects winning, particularly defensively. But at the end of the day, like, he can't create. He is one of the least creative sort of 3-4s, as many other wonderful things as he does on the floor. And in a lot of series, he's indispensable. But it is a problem. And Hood can at least give you some shot creation because you end up in these sort of fire drill emergency situations so often against the Warriors.
The only benefit of not using Kanter as your screener, of using someone else they're not guarding, is that it keeps Kanter in position to get offensive rebounds. But even that works better when you have another shooter on the floor. And I think they will play that way.
Well, see, I think actually he's better off as an offensive rebounder when he, when there's a screen, when he is the screener, because often they'll switch. He ends up with a small.
True.
Kanter's actually, if the plan is he can save 7 possessions a game for us tonight, 6-7, I'd almost keep him as a screener, let him switch. Now Kanter's got the guard on him, and now, you know, he can play that a little bit. It's tough. I mean, I love what Portland's done. They've been a great story. I don't envy them at all. I mean, it's an impossible situation. You're playing the Warriors at peak confidence.
I think they get one at home, and we have the proverbial gentleman sweep in Oracle in whenever Game 5 is. Who is, snap prediction, who's winning tonight in Milwaukee?
Milwaukee.
I think so, too. I think this goes 2-0 going to Toronto, and then it's gut check time for the Drakes. And I will be there in Toronto and, if necessary, in Milwaukee next week, so we will break bread perhaps then. But Kevin Arnovitz, it's always wonderful to have you on. Go get psyched for what is going to be a raucous game 2 at the Fiserv Forum. Oh my God, by the way, the scene outside that arena is Jurassic Park times 3. There are so many people
like
there.
Beers. Like, what is it? It's like, we need a name for it.
Yeah, does it have a name yet?
Like, where is a place where like deers sort of do their, I don't know, deer things.
Yeah, it can't be a corporate name, although Jurassic Park, I guess, is a corporate name in its own way, but that organically flows a little bit.
That's pretty organic. I mean, yeah,
we need to find a good name for contemporary life,
it's relatively organic, yeah.
Man, Milwaukee is going to be the capital of Eastern Conference basketball if Giannis stays there. So enjoy the game tonight. I also think the Bucks will win, and I will see you soon north of the border in my beloved Toronto. Thank you, sir.
Talk to you soon.
The Low Post is presented by Goodyear. Discover the possibilities. Goodyear, more driven.